welcome to the latest episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria.
Hello.
And special guest Catherine Cannings. How are you doing?
Hi, Enda. Hi, Maria. I'm great. Thank you.
It's so wonderful having you here on the pod. And we'll start where we always start with our interviewees, especially when they're from outside of Madrid. What brought you to the Spanish capital? And maybe more interestingly, what has made you stay here for the last few years?
Okay, well, actually, before moving to Madrid, I'd lived in other places in Spain. So initially, it was the opportunity to teach in the Socrates program after I graduated. And randomly, they sent me to Cáceres in Extremadura. And I started learning Spanish there. I moved back to London. Met my now husband, who is Spanish, came back to Salamanca with him. We lived there a while. We moved to La Palma in the Canary Islands. We were there for 2 years. And I felt like I was missing out on things. I mean, it's a beautiful place, but we felt we needed a bit more, you know, sort of city life, work opportunities, a bit more sort of cultural buzz. So we decided to move to Madrid. And we've been here ever since. We've stayed, I suppose, because those things that tie you down, work, we had children, bought a house, got a mortgage. So that's why we've ended up staying. Although, we're possibly thinking about a move in the future, possibly somewhere else in Spain.
Wow, that's pretty impressive because a lot of people maybe just come to Madrid or go, for example, to the coast or to the Canary Islands, but you've done a couple of interesting places. And also, Cáceres, for example, is not such a common place for foreigners to go. So that's really good. A lot of what you do, which we're going to talk about through the interview, involves the arts, doesn't it? Especially theater and books. So are there things that you grew up with? Were you really surrounded by them, when you were little, or do you develop an interest later maybe?
Well, books, definitely. I definitely grew up surrounded by books. I was lucky to have parents who are, you know, they're huge readers. They still are. So I grew up in a house full of books. I always read everything I could get my hands on. I was a real bookworm. I went on to study European literature at university, basically just because, you know, I loved reading so much. Theatre, not so much. In fact, I was quite shy, I think. I never dreamt of being on stage or on screen. No desire to do that at all. But books definitely have been, you know, a big part of my life and now my professional life, of course.
And speaking of your professional life, I think what is really interesting is that, because you have a background in books, as you've mentioned, and you've also previously collaborated with Clan, a family channel on Spanish TV. And, you know, there are sometimes people who set up maybe English academies directed towards kids or diaries or workshops. But I imagine you're quite unique in this respect. How did this come about? And what was your experience of collaborating with Spanish TV?
Right. Well, initially when I came to Madrid, I was working for a clothing company. So I was a production manager, nothing to do with books, with English teaching at all. When I had a baby, I realized I couldn't carry on doing that because it involved, you know, a lot of travel. I was traveling to the Far East, the UK, all around Spain. So I left and I thought now's my opportunity to do something, you know, that involves books. And at that point, I'm talking like 17 years ago or a bit more, it was actually quite hard to find English books in Madrid. I mean, you could go to El Corte Inglés or, like I said, Libro, but Amazon didn't exist, or existed, maybe didn't exist in Spain. So I imported books from the UK, started, you know, promoting, selling them in schools with the storytelling events. And so then the company started to grow to what it is today. It's called La Hora del Cuento. And we, you know, we do English activities, theatre, storytelling, escape rooms for schools. And so from that, I've actually, you know, I've got a lot of opportunities have come from that, in like the collaboration with Clan, with the TV show Aprendemos in Clan, that I filmed a segment on for a couple of years, and that was amazing. That was a really, really fun thing to do. And but like I said before, it was nothing I've ever dreamt of doing. It's all kind of grown organically, but I'm very happy about it.
Clan always grabbed my attention as a name as well. It's actually quite similar to the Irish word for family, clown, as well. So maybe there's a linguistic curiosity there.
It's called that.
We get Maria to give her esteemed opinion as a Spanish person in a moment about that. But you mentioned this, the escape rooms, which kind of jumped out at me. So that sounds so like really interesting for the kids to do that. I can only imagine though, that must be difficult to set up and manage. Like escape room in a school. How do you handle that side of it?
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, an escape room that you would go to, that you actually go to the room and it's all very, very immersive and themed. Although we try to do that as much as possible. I mean, we bring a lot of material into the schools. The decoration and sound and little sets and things. What we do is we split them up into groups, so they're all working on solving their little bit of the puzzle or for the story, and then they come together at the end to solve the challenge. But it's a format that works so well, I would say, from sort of age 10 upwards, because, you know, they're very competitive at that age. They don't want to maybe listen to a story because they think they're too old for that. Theatre is not so interactive because what we aim to do is, you know, create a natural environment as possible for learning English. So, you know, we want something that the kids are going to get really hooked on. They're going to get involved in. They're emotionally invested in that. So we find that challenges and, you know, escape rooms work so well for schools. We do them from the age of around 10 up to 18-year-olds, and all different themes. We've got the curse of the mummy, the mad scientist, so they're looking for the antidote for a virus. Black butterflies one, where they, you know, there's evil spirits around and they have to solve a mystery. Yeah, they're really good fun.
Well, it sounds it even for adults. It sounds really cool. First of all, you were talking about Clan before. I think that's probably one of the. I never thought of this, but I guess it's an interesting thing that word works in many languages. I never stopped. Even if my nephews are watching, you know, that channel nonstop, I never stopped to think about the actual name. You've talked about all the different things in the escape room, for example, and it just sounds like, you know, so many different resources really that you incorporate into teaching. So how important do you think that is, you know, to go beyond the traditional materials and do all these different activities? And I don't know, do you feel like your background has helped you develop? You mentioned originally you didn't. You weren't working on that. You were working on clothing. So, do you feel your experiences have helped you develop those different materials as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, my experience over the years, it's grown having children as well and working with children now for so many years. You get to see them at all the different stages. You know what they're interested in. You know, it depends on the age and the stage of the child. And I've always felt like, language learning is about communication, and it's a two-way thing. So it's not just about a class sitting and listening, which is still the case in many teaching environments, especially in Spain, I think. So I've always felt they have to participate, they have to interact. And so that's why we try and bring everything into the learning experience, you know. So like I said, you know, the older children, they like the competitive things. Right now we've got a Pokemon challenges for 7 to 10-year-olds. It's kind of competition. They love that. Little children, you know, they need to get emotionally invested in the story. We've got a story about, for example, a mummy owl who leaves her baby owls alone at night. And, you know, the 3-year-olds really, they live that experience, and they're listening in English and they're responding. So I think it's important to bring all kinds of resources definitely into language teaching, you know, movement, especially for the younger ones, they need to be moving, music, crafts. We do crafts as well with the younger children, and emotion is very important.
It's pretty amazing everything that you're telling us, because I remember, you know, as a Spaniard here when I was growing up, really at school, there was nothing of this. And, you know, even like the teacher that we had, sometimes they've never even been abroad or they've been to maybe London a couple of times, it was a completely different world. And it's just amazing to think of, you know, maybe like 30 years ago and now how things have changed and all these resources that have been developed, you know, by people like you.
Yeah, I think it's changed a lot, the teaching within schools in Spain, especially in infant and primary. I think secondary still got a way to go with more innovative teaching methods, but definitely I've seen a huge change in primary schools and the way languages and everything has been taught. Because we're really lucky, I always think, we see schools from an interesting perspective. We go to a different school almost every day. I mean, as a parent, you'll see a school. As a teacher, you see your school. But, you know, we're visiting, we're seeing the schools from within, we're going into the classroom. So I can really get to see what schools are like.
And when you're talking about children and learning, schools, of course, are very important, but also the household, you know, especially if they're growing up in a bilingual environment. And I know you have another project called Roadmap to Your Bilingual Home, this is a very interesting project because it addresses and tries to help people navigate the challenges maybe of raising kids in a bilingual environment. And as a mother who has experience of this yourself, what are the keys for doing this successfully? How do you know when to speak English and how do you know when to speak Spanish and those kind of things?
Right. Well, I started this project because that's probably the question I most have been asked over the years. You know, how have you raised your children bilingually? How can I do this? How can my child learn languages? What's the best way? And the answer is there's no right answer, basically. It depends. Every family is so different, has different circumstances, has different motivations, has different goals for why, you know, they want their children to learn languages and which languages they want them to learn. So I started this because there's so much information out there. There's a huge amount of information about different strategies, different ways of you know, bringing up children bilingually or multilingually. And I found that, you know, as a parent, you're really busy anyway. You know, there's so many theories and different ways of everything for your child, you know, how to feed them, how to talk to them. But you're putting a language onto that's another layer of complication. And parents just don't have time to plow through this information, a lot of which is written by, you know, academics, speech pathologists, researchers, which is amazing. You know, they really know what they're talking about, but it's often written in a way that, you know, a busy mom will not want to plow through and read and find the best way of doing it. So that's why I started this, just working with bilingual families, sort of finding out about their family, finding out practical ways of how they can incorporate, you know, languages into their daily life. You know, by finding out exactly what their goals are, what you want to achieve. Do you want your child to be just to speak another language? Do you want them to be literate in that language? Do you want them to also know all about the culture that comes with speaking that language? I mean, there's so many different stages as well of bilingualism, which I think, you know, I think it's a very personal thing. So yeah, I've written a book which will be published later this year. Which helps you, which kind of guides you through, you know, your motivations, your goals, the strategies that could work best for your family. It's fun. It's got quizzes. It's got, you know, resources, worksheets that help you do that, you know, possible problems. So which I'm also turning into an online course as well. And I hope to continue working with families one-to-one as well with that. But yeah, I'm sorry not to give you the best ways to do this, but there are lots of ways to go about it, and it really depends on, you know, your resources, your time, and your goals.
It sounds really wonderful. I'm sure like there'll be lots of families who really benefit from that. And I'm really intrigued by the book. It sounds wonderful as well. And I'm particularly intrigued by, you know, because a lot of your work, you're kind of hands-on and you're with people and you're talking to them and everything. And writing, of course, is famously a solitary pursuit. So did you enjoy the process of writing the book as maybe a change of pace, or was it a challenge?
Absolutely, I do. I do. I mean, from Laura Quinter, I've taken a step back because I have a great team now who go into the schools and deliver a lot of the activities. So I have time to work on my personal project. So I really enjoy it. I do enjoy having that alone contemplative time. Although I have to say, during my research for the book, I talked to lots of families. I interviewed multilingual families all around the world, and sort of anecdotes and stories from them are in the book as well. So it was a collaborative experience as well. I wasn't just sitting on my own writing.
It sounds like a really useful resource, because in Spain, for example, a lot of the time, you know, kids maybe go to bilingual programs, or, you know, but it's not always that easy. And sometimes the parents have difficulties as well knowing when to implement. And you see them, I don't know, in the park trying really hard to ask like the kid a question in English. And and sometimes like they have their own shortcomings as well. So it sounds like it would be a really useful thing. It's a really useful thing in Spain, definitely. Where perhaps, you know, bilingual homes are not as common as maybe in other.
I would say in Spain they're very common, because I mean, if you think of, in fact, I would say the majority of Spain is already bilingual. If you think of all the
Valencian, yes. definitely.
Because I've written about doesn't necessarily apply to, you know, a bilingual home in Spanish and English. It applies to any language at all. So
I'm glad I mentioned that, because that's a very important. Yeah, we're talking about bilingual. We're instantly assuming English and Spanish. But yes, of course, you're right, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's obviously a Spanish reality for a lot of people, and it doesn't get talked about enough, or we don't even appreciate it enough in Spain itself. So very good point. I stand corrected. So, but you've done a lot of things. I mean, here in Madrid, even like you've contributed to Madrid Metropolitan, which is a magazine here that, you know, English speaking community reads, and they have a lot of articles on different cultural things. What do you think about the English speaking community here in Madrid? Do you find that, you know, there's kind of like a dynamic and like an interesting group of people maybe collaborating, or how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I definitely think it has. It's, you know, more and more every year. When I first arrived in Madrid, I remember I thought, this is such a Spanish city, you know. It was definitely very Spanish, and every, you know, it's more and more diverse and vibrant, English speaking, and, you know, different nationalities. There's Madrid Metropolitan, of course. When my children were younger, I remember going to, you know, English speaking parent and toddler group, which was amazing. My daughter's part of British Scouts here in Madrid, which she absolutely loves. I'm a part of a really, really good group of women in business. It's called IWBB, International Women in Business. That's been really supportive. I've met many, you know, inspiring people through that. So that's sort of my experience of the international community in Madrid. But I have to say, you know, I'm married to a Spaniard. We have, you know, I'm very sort of part of the Spanish community, perhaps more than the English-speaking community.
Was that a conscious choice? You know, but sometimes when we go to a different place, we tend to, you know, not necessarily join, you know, people from our own country, just to make sure that we learn and experience all the things. And other people are the other way around. As soon as they get to a place, they just look for their country fellow people. So was that a conscious decision you made, or it just happened?
I think it sort of just happened really through circumstance, through our sort of friend circle. You know, when you have children, you you kind of hang out with the parents of your children's friends as well a lot. So yeah, we ended up having quite a Spanish circle. But, you know, having said that, I have that sort of contact. I have, you know, friends who are English speaking in Madrid as well. But I say it's around 50-50 or maybe tending towards Spanish. Now, I mean, I spent my whole adult life in Spain, so I don't really feel British, particularly. Right. I don't feel Spanish. I don't feel British. But yeah, my whole adult life has been in Spain. So I've grown up here in a way as well.
And finally, Catherine, this is especially all this conversation has been fascinating. And just to kind of, I guess, touch on just the last part of it, because you did mention in one of your answers to Maria about the other languages here in the city as well, and the bilingual aspects. You know, there's a lot of cultures here and a lot of languages as a consequence. And, you know, obviously you're involved in English teaching and English books and kind of English speaking culture, like we are as well as teachers and translators and publishers and writers as well ourselves. And, it's kind of the English language has a curious position in the world because it seems to have preeminence over other languages. It's the language of science and global culture. Even somebody who doesn't speak a word of the language will maybe know a few lyrics from a Taylor Swift song or something like that. Do you get a sense that that influence of English is disproportionate, or is it something that's just neutral and just reflects how the world is? I don't know. It's a complicated question, but what are your personal feelings around its position?
I think we could talk hours probably about this, or I could anyway. So obviously, I would say most people in Spain who want to learn a language want to learn English, or want their child to learn English, because it's, you know, it's important in today's world, globalized world, career wise, that sort of thing. But, you know, promoting other languages is equally crucial, you know, for preserving the diversity, you know, maintaining heritage, culture, seeing different perspectives, different concepts. I mean, I'm thinking of something that kind of annoyed me when my children were younger. I would get told so often, oh, you're so lucky your children are bilingual. Aren't they lucky? Aren't they lucky? And I would think, yeah, they're lucky. But I bet, you know, Moroccan parents aren't told that on a daily basis, you know, who have children here in Spain and they're Spanish and, you know, they speak, you know, Darija or Arabic. I don't think it, you know, because English is still seen as sort of more valuable, more prestigious, you know, because of the role of history, colonialism. You know, we don't really want to get into all that debate. But yeah, English is obviously seen as precision. And obviously, I'm working in teaching English and spreading English as well. But I want to mention I'm also part of a project called Peach, which is involved in promoting languages throughout Europe. It's called, I have to write it down actually what Peach means. It means it's a EU project. So it's funded by the EU and I'm an ambassador and I help run the social media. And it's called Preserving and Promoting Europe's Cultural and Linguistic Heritage Through Empowerment of Bilingual Children and Families. That's what PEACH stands for, apparently. So this has been running about 4 years. I've been involved from the outset. And it's basically about supporting bilingual families across Europe, you know, whatever their languages are. So it could be Basque and Arabic and Spanish. You know, it could be any languages. So it's about you know, emphasizing linguistic diversity and maintaining and cultivating that. So what we do is we run events, we have the social media, we have resources and guides for parents and educators, and talk about best practices, talk about, you know, sort of myths and mistaken beliefs surrounding bilingualism. So that's a really cool project. If you can put that link in your podcast, that's all about, you know, it's about promoting languages in whatever languages they are. So I'm happy to be part of that cool project.
Definitely. You can count on that. We'll put that link and all the other fascinating things you do into the description. Honestly, what you do is amazing, and it's very inspiring that you're so active and across these different language fields and sectors. So you can count on us putting that into the description But Catherine, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been great. Thank you.